down at this end tonight.
It's 9 o'clock in the evening at Newlyn Docks in Cornwall, and Andrew Pascoe's gill netter, the Lamorna, has just arrived back after a day's fishing. He's now unloading his cargo. Has it been a good day?
Not bad yet. We've had worse days. The weather's been good as well, which is this time of year is always a bonus.
So what have you got?
Probably 240 stone, mostly pollock, a few cod and a few ling, a few haddock.
How does this compare, though, perhaps to the catch that your father would have brought in 15 years ago?
Oh, nothing really compared to that. The quantities especially would have been... The variety in the species would have been the same, but the quantities would have been 3, 4, 5 times as much. It isn't anywhere near as good as it used to be. It's no good trying to kid ourselves about that.
In the last 10 or so years, about 40 boats have been decommissioned and have left the fleet. The difficulty is, as we improve our technology and our navigation and all these sorts of things, there's no place that we don't go now. There's no stone unturned, as it were. And whereas in the past that we simply couldn't trawl over the rockiest areas, and there were for other reasons we couldn't fish in certain places because we simply didn't have the technology, now that's no longer true.
The remorseless decline local fishermen Sam Lamborn and Andrew Pascoe are brooding on is hard to fathom from the busy quayside at Newlyn, England's biggest and most profitable fishing port, where boats of all shapes and sizes, gill netters, beam trawlers, crab and lobster potters, jostle for position to land their catch. But the Cornish fleet has been decimated in recent years, and that's a story that's echoed not just in British waters, but across the high seas. Don Kent runs the Hubs SeaWorld Research Institute on the Pacific coast of Southern California.
It's estimated that over two-thirds of the world's fish populations are either fully exploited or overexploited. Over the last 15 years, I've seen requests for proposals coming in from management agencies wanting us to look at ways we could exploit new stocks of fish that had never been touched before. And then a decade later, they're sending us requests for proposals to try to understand what happened to the fish stock because we never managed it during that exploitation. And this is a scenario that's being repeated around the world. Here in Southern California, 10 years ago, the Chilean sea bass came on the market, and all the chefs were excited about it. The seafood processors were excited about it. It's a fish that's caught in the long line in the gillnet fisheries off of Chile. Here it is a decade later, and they're thinking of listing the species. And again, that's getting repeated around the world. So as the world population grows, it's estimated that the current supply of seafood available to feed this world is going to have to double. And yet we've already maxed out what we can get from the ocean. And all of our research here on enhancing wild stocks is designed to keep what's already out there available for the next 100 years.
The inescapable conclusion, we've squandered the abundant resources of the world's oceans. Our limited attempts to compensate for that maxing out, fish farming, have created as many problems as they've solved. Water supplies in the prawn farms of Southeast Asia are depleted and polluted. Salmon farming in Scotland is blamed by some for the demise of wild stocks. But now help may be at hand. Russ George took me out on his research ship, the Sanctuary, to demonstrate how you could feed the world with iron.
It's been interesting because this is a new batch of material that I've just gotten, and just to see what kind of dispersion it has. So there's just a few teaspoonfuls of this iron ochre, red ochre, in a couple of gallons of water. And that's pretty much typically how one would put it out at sea when one was actually doing this work.
You don't need to spray it out or spread it or anything. You just tip it into the water.
Well, yeah, one might spray it, you know, when it was being done at a large scale. You know, if we were trying to add nutrient to, say, 100 square miles of ocean, then one might want to have the material, you know, spread out as much as you could, and then you'd just plow that patch of ocean, you know, with a ship, and then let the currents and the wind disperse it.
Now, we've left quite a trail behind us here of what really looks just like red paint in the water.
Right, and it is more or less red paint. It's the red pigment from paint. It doesn't have all the oils and other things in it that paint has. And that's iron ore dust, basically, which is the same material that blows in off of, you know, sometimes here in the Bay Area, sometimes we can measure the dust coming from the Gobi Desert from China. and it can actually be collected on filters, and it's the same red dust as we see here.
So what happens now?
If you get 100 miles out to sea, the coastal plankton have eaten all the iron up. They let essentially no coastal iron escape to the open ocean. So as soon as the iron arrives in open sea areas, the plankton have evolved to be opportunistic and to grab that right away. And in fact, the first thing that happens is nitrogen-fixing bacteria grab hold of some of the iron. That stimulates their growth. They begin to fix nitrogen out of the atmosphere, which enriches the macronutrient nitrogen of the ocean, and the phytoplankton also get the iron, which stimulates their growth. And in the presence of their nitrogen-fixing bacterial symbionts, they now have the macronutrients that they need and the micronutrients. Within a week or so, you get a beginning of a bloom, and within 2 weeks, the bloom is in full swing.
So really, you're kick-starting the growth process, life in the oceans.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we intend to do, is to try to mimic exactly what Mother Nature does. When a dust storm blows off a desert, it drifts over a different path of ocean every time, depending on the vagaries of the wind. So as one patch of ocean under a dust event is fertilized with iron, it blooms, and it blooms for a month to 3 months, and then that bloom is done with. And then another dust storm has maybe drifted over a different patch of ocean. So the patches of ocean that have bloomed have months or whatever time between that and the next dust storm to recover and to mix with other ocean water and to replenish the nutrients.
You've created all this phytoplankton, this pea soup effect in the sea, and that really leads to a huge explosion of growth of life in the water.
Right, the phytoplankton, the plant plankton, is the bottom of the food chain in the ocean. And so, you know, all manner of small animal life feeds on that, from the tiniest zooplankton, animal plankton, to shrimps, to krill, to sardines and tuna and salmon and the great whales. You know, all are feeding on this, the plants that are the grazing food of the ocean.
So you can create your own farm system here, really. I mean, you can manufacture bigger and better fish, more populations of animals that we might want to farm.
Yeah, perhaps. That, you know, certainly plankton blooms do stimulate fish production. And so, you know, in a natural occurring bloom, one's out at sea and finds a naturally occurring plankton bloom, one frequently finds large populations of fish concentrated there and feeding there. So that's certainly one of the benefits that may well occur from these plankton experiments.
It's a beautifully simple idea, fish from iron filings, and one that Michael Markels of Ocean Farming has been trying to sell to governments and major corporations around the world. His dream is to seed a 3 million square mile patch of the southern oceans, producing enough fish to feed the world.
That 3 million square mile patch should produce, if it was all fertilized, about 50 million tons of fish in this long-term fertilization scheme that we've talked about. The last numbers I have, that the average value of fish caught in the ocean is about 36 cents a pound, which means $730 a ton. That 50 million tons is $36 billion worth of fish. That's a lot of fish. The 50 million tons compares to about 112 million tons of fish that are caught each year. So this would be a large increase in the production of what we now call wild fish, although it would be fish that we would create in the ocean.
But there is another and potentially even more lucrative benefit from ocean fertilization as a solution to global warming. Russ George again.
My work has been sponsored by industrial partners, energy companies, whose interest is in mitigating the impact of their burning of fossil fuels to generate power. And so they're mainly interested in a way to solve the world's CO2 problem.
Explain how it works.
The plankton pulls carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. They grow. And when a plant grows, it produces a cell wall. If that's a tree, that's the cell wall makes up the wood of the tree. And even though ocean plankton are very small, they're like individual cells in a tree. And so they're producing carbonaceous cell material out of the CO2 and other nutrients, and some of that material is eaten by the other organisms, but probably a third to a half of it eventually sinks to the deep water of the ocean. And there, the deep water circulation in the world's oceans is something on the scale of 1,000 years, a millennial time scale. So once the phytoplankton have sunk out of the active growing zone of the ocean, then they're likely in a circulation system that's going to take on the order of 1,000 years before that material might resurface somewhere else in the ocean.
So that's carbon out of the system.
Yeah, so that is now carbon that is considered sequestered. It's been exported out of the immediate biosphere.
If Russ George can measure how much carbon dioxide is being stored as dead phytoplankton sink to the bottom, he's sure the car and energy industries will pay to offset the pollution they cause. But there are a few hurdles still to be overcome before the problems of global warming and world hunger are solved. Initially, at least, there's a question of legality. The deep oceans may be outside territorial waters, but that doesn't mean it's a free-for-all. Rennie Coonan is the secretary of the London Convention, which governs the dumping of waste at sea.
Some contracting parties clearly say CO2 generated from when you have electricity production and it generates CO2, we regard as industrial waste. So we would not allow that. And if others would give permits, do it on a massive scale, we would object to that. That is one body of thinking. Others might say, well, we do not regard it as CO2, as waste, and dumping should be allowed. On the scientific side, people are very interested, understandably, on how effective the whole mechanism would be. But then, of course, the question comes back, well, at what cost can you see an effect, and does it make a substantive contribution to solving the initial problem, which is an excess of CO2 in the atmosphere? If it's such an important thing that to use the oceans for CO2, then you may have to amend the convention or any other agreement to make it happen. I don't rule that out at all, but that's certainly something that would take years to solve that. So you would have a body of opinion there developing, and then maybe with quite tempestuous discussions, you can be sure.
And there are practical concerns from marine biologists like Professor Viktor Smetacek of the Wegener Institute in Germany and Professor Andrew Watson of the University of East Anglia. He's a veteran of earlier fertilising expeditions and just back from a conference on the subject in Hawaii.
Amongst the things that were discussed there were the results from the latest scientific iron fertilisation experiment that was carried out by the Japanese in the Northeast Pacific. They also found very large enhancements of plankton productivity when they added iron, the largest that have been seen so far, in fact. The results, though even more spectacular than some of the previous results, have basically confirmed what these experiments have shown consistently over the last 10 years. However, it's one thing to show that you get a bloom of plankton, and quite a different thing to show either that fish production will be enhanced or that there will be sequestration of carbon. Neither of those things is anywhere near proved by these kinds of relatively small-scale experiments.
Well, we found out in the last couple of years that the ocean, the open ocean, is iron limited, that there's not enough iron to meet the demands of the phytoplankton. Now, this does not apply to the coastal areas and the shelf areas because they get their iron from the continents. So the major fisheries are located in these coastal areas and shelf areas like the North Sea. Now, the open ocean is fish poor and there are very few small fish stocks there. And the idea here is that by fertilizing the ocean, that we will increase fish stocks. The point, of course, is that there are no fish that we know of that would grow. Those stocks are not there because today's fish stocks live on the shelves, and the shelves have a sufficiency of iron.
It's a point Michael Markels concedes, but he says you could just as easily supply your own fish to feed off the plankton bloom.
We may in fact have to add our seed with fish that can eat the phytoplankton we're creating. They may not be able to get there if we're way out in the middle of the ocean, and so we may have to add anchoveta and things like that.
We just don't know enough. We know so far that it would work, which makes it all the more dangerous. I mean, it would be easy to say it's not going to work, right? That was the opinion 5 years ago. But now we know that it's going to work. It work in the sense that you will build up phytoplankton. But what the fate of that phytoplankton is, we don't know. That's the next step. And as you know, science progresses stepwise. So we've just done the first two steps, in a sense, right? We need to get much more information on further down the road before we would allow anything like that to happen.
You know what people are going to say? You're mucking about in the dark here. You don't really know what you're doing. We know very little about the ecosystems of the ocean. Here you are tampering with those ecosystems, producing blooms, producing huge changes, and really the consequences are unknown.
Well, and in fact, that's exactly the question that we seek to ask, is what are the consequences? So the Planktos Foundation has been set up to really do about 5 year, we have a 5 year research program, starting out in test tube laboratory scale work. We're going to move in shortly into what are called mesocosm enclosures, which are giant plastic bags moored out in the ocean, where we can add nutrients and then, but in a contained environment and look at it. And then we'll get into the macro scale testing, which is adding iron in patches, forest-sized patches of ocean. And the challenge is to measure all of the environmental effects and all of the engineering requirements to find out whether this is feasible from an engineering economic point of view and also environmentally sound. And if both of those questions say yes, and we can find a market, you know, corporations that are willing to pay, you know, perhaps 10% of their carbon mitigation money into this channel of carbon mitigation, then we'll have a small business here.
It was 150 years after we started burning fossil fuels that we worked out we had a problem with carbon and the greenhouse effect. We can't afford to make the same mistake with the world's oceans.
Well, of course, the world's oceans are right now undergoing the greatest experiment man's ever done, which is increasing the global concentration of CO2. So we're well underway on our greatest human experiment with the planet.
For now, the science of ocean fertilization remains unproven. A more immediate impact on the feeding of the multitude might be made if we took a few steps up the food chain, from iron filings to juvenile fish. At the Hubs SeaWorld Research Institute, Don Kent has done just that, last year releasing 100,000 white sea bass in a bid to sustain dwindling native stocks along California's Pacific coast.
We're outside one of the four brood stock tanks right now that have 50 adult white sea bass, 25 males and 25 females. They range in size from 20 pounds to 50 pounds.
You've got a good viewing window here, and these are really beautiful, kind of silver color, and a very nice dorsal fin there, spiky
yes.
fin.
They're a beautiful representative of the croaker family. You can even see some vertical stripes on them that are left over from when they're fish and living in the eelgrass. Actually, this light doesn't do them justice. If you look at them in sunlight, they actually have a, as you rotate them, they have an iridescence, almost an orange or purplish glint to them. And they're really quite attractive in open sunlight.
But any one of these would break the record for a salmon in the UK. I mean,
would it? Yeah, I guess. The record catch for this species is 85 pounds.
And this is the brood stock. This is what you get the eggs from for
yes.
the other tanks we've got around here.
Exactly. They spawn right in this pool. We manipulate the amount of daylight that they have in a 24-hour period and raise the water temperature. And by making them think it's the oncoming of spring, meaning the days are getting longer and the water warmer, they think it's time to spawn. And so we can manipulate the four different brood stocks to spawn any time during the year.
So you've got both males and females in this one tank of, what is it, about 20, 30 feet in diameter?
Yeah, it's about 12,000 gallons total.
And the eggs come out and into these smaller tanks here,
right? Right. We're circulating the water through here at a rate of about, well, the whole tank turns over every hour and a half, say. And when they spawn in the evening, the eggs simply are buoyant. They're what we call pelagic eggs. They float, and so they transport out of the tank with the water and simply get caught in these large mesh bags that we have in the outside sumps. We come in the morning, we collect the eggs, we put them into a graduated cylinder, and that serves two functions. One, the eggs that aren't fertilized sink to the bottom, and the fertile eggs float to the top. Then we take those floating eggs and then we move them over to an incubator and stock them into a deeper tank for the first 3 weeks of the larvae's life.
And these are the tanks we can see dotted around here. They're not quite as big, but you've got fish in various stages of development here.
We have fish in different pools here that range in size from a tenth of an inch upwards of 8 inches in length. And difference in age of being from just hatched, or just the eggs being spawned 3 days ago, upwards of fish that have been here for 10 months.
So once the fish have been through all these stages, been through all these tanks, the end result is that you release them back out into the ocean?
Yes, that's right. These are all what we call F1 progeny. They're the first generation. They're one step away from these brood stock that were all captured from the wild. And so we've tried to mimic the wild fish as much as possible. So what goes out of the hatchery is as close to a wild fish as what's out there already. And the whole intent of the program is to see if we can help Mother Nature sustain the level of fish that are out there in the wild, even with pressure being applied by humans to capture those fish back out and harvest them.
And the idea is to regenerate that natural store of fish in the ocean.
Well, we estimate that for this particular species, the stock is less than 10% of what it was 50 years ago. And what we would like to do is see if adopting all the other management schemes that have been applied, you know, a number of fish that you're allowed to catch, the type of gear, the time of year, all those factors, if we apply those as well as breeding in hundreds of thousands of juveniles a year, if we can't sort of kickstart the population back up to where it was historically and then manage it properly. I'd like nothing better than for this population to be self-sustaining at its historic level and be managed properly so that it never has to get into the state it dropped into 50 years ago, or from 50 years of harvesting. And when that day occurs, then this facility will be switched over to working on a different species.
How can you guarantee that these fish you're growing here will end up in a gill net somewhere down the coast or on the end of a sport fisherman's line? I mean, once they're out in the ocean, they're free, they can do what they like. They don't have to loiter around here and contribute back to the economy of California.
We can't guarantee. If we could guarantee, then what we'd in effect be saying is that every fish that is released from here is going to be caught in the wild. And if that were the case, then the population would be completely gone. Every fish out there would have already been caught. No, what we're trying to do here is get that population back up to where it was and make it self-sustaining. And in that way, I think that'll be a tremendous contribution back to the stock to have 2 million white sea bass swimming off the California coast again instead of 100,000 will be a great complement to the wild population.
The white sea bass is a coastal water species living along the edge of a deep, wide ocean, and there's a pretty good chance that Don Kent's fish will be caught by Californian fishermen. The fishing rights in European waters are altogether more complicated. No one country can be sure its fishermen will net any return on a similar investment. But even here, the concept of sea ranching is taking hold. And because you can be pretty sure they'll stay roughly where you put them, the lobster has been identified as ripe for cultivation. Phil Midgley runs the National Lobster Hatchery at Padstow in Cornwall, where thousands of tiny animals are nurtured through the most vulnerable stages of their lives.
Because lobster larvae are attracted to light, this is basically their biggest downfall in the wild. When the larvae hatch out at, let's say, 20 to 25 metres, they naturally have the need to go to the pelagic area of the water column, where you have
that's
the
higher up in the water, where it's nice and bright and sunny.
That's right. Where there's plenty of nutrients for them to eat, but also it's a place where you've got the high, especially in the southwest region, we have a high presence of basking sharks, pelagic species like mackerel, sprat, herring. So not only do you have the heavy predation on the delicate larvae, which form part of the plankton chain, you also have the winds, the currents, the tides, the very robust nature of the environment to contend with. So this is, of course, when the majority of the lobster larvae will actually die, and the figures suggest that we have about a 99% mortality rate in the first 2 weeks of its own life cycle. We grow them to an inch long in these pots, which is about 3 months old, and then we release them out into the wild. Now, working on the survival ship of releasing them at 3 months suggests that we get about an 80% survival rate to adulthood. So it's an incredible margin of controlling them within past the vulnerable stages of the larval to the juvenile stage.
And what about the release? You don't just tip them over the side, but actually by putting them on the seabed through a tube in a specific location.
That's right. We use the St. Piran, which is the Cornwall Sea Fisheries Committee's patrol vessel. We have an apparatus on the vessel which basically pumps water down a tube. There are divers down on the seabed holding the tube and also taking video footage of the releases. As they travel down the tube, they're not actually coming into contact with the tube, so there's no abrasiveness there. They're traveling down, it's like a water slide in effect. And then when they come out, they're being observed for the first 20 seconds, 30 seconds, and the majority, if not all, are actually burrowing down and finding they are quite comfortable in the environment that we're actually releasing them into.
As with Don Kent's sea bass scheme, it is an astonishingly expensive way to support native stocks and bring the oceans back to life. But if we want to eat fish fresh from the sea rather than a farm cage, it's a price we'll simply have to pay. For fishermen like Sam Lambourne, romantic notions about their role as hunters of the deep may go the same way as so many of Newlyn's boats.
I think we've really got to take action about stock recovery and put into place measures that really are going to have a difference.
What about efforts like that going on at Padstow, the lobster hatchery there, trying to rebuild a stock to create a sustainable stock that has been whittled away over decades?
Any of these measures that begin to make us think more like farmers and less like hunters, I think have got to be a step in the right direction. We all recognise as fishermen that it isn't an infinite resource and that more and more we have got to look to how we harvest that resource so that we don't catch too many.
This is an area famous for its small fishing villages. There must be a lot of people out there looking to you and hoping that you are the answer to their prayers. Fishing villages where many people have gone out of business recently, where catches are getting lower and lower. They look at this, at what you're doing here, and think maybe there's still some hope for the fishing industry around here.
Well, I hope so. The fishing industry has been hit hard over the last 20, 30 years, and we hope that we are a ray of hope, at least within the lobsters as far as the hatchery is concerned. But there is indeed research and quite concrete evidence to suggest that we can work with cod, we can work with halibut. There's other species that we can culture as far as whether it be a ranching program or actually controlling the whole of the life cycle. There are 800 jobs, 400 vessels that target lobsters within Cornwall and the Isles of Scilly in very fragile fishing communities, communities that rely heavily on the sea, rely heavily on tradition, on the historical methods of potting, of catching lobsters, and we need to allow this to prosper and to continue.